Hey everyone, Tom Salemi here. Welcome back to Device Talks Weekly. This episode is brought to you by our friends at Lydium Medical. You can find out more about Lydium in this episode. Kaylee and Brown will be sitting down with them and sharing their story. And of course, you can find out more information at Lydium's website, Lydium.com. That's Lydium.com. This is a fantastic episode. We've got lots coming your way. We have our keynote conversation with Ray Cohen, who was one of our keynotes at Device Talks West. Ray Cohen has had some fantastic success lately. That is an understatement in building and selling companies to larger medical device companies. And we'll unpack those secrets in that conversation. You'll find that a little later in the podcast. Before that, Kayleen Brown will sit down with Dr. Sarah Matt. This is this week's FOMO. And Dr. Matt has become a great friend of Device Talks, and she's now an author. Her book, The Borderless Healthcare Revolution, has come out. And Sarah Matt's got a great perspective being a physician, having spent time at Oracle, having spent time at MedTech. She moves easily between all three worlds. And I think the book really delves into solutions, into how technology can break down some walls and really get healthcare to the folks who need it. So a great conversation with Dr. Sarah Matt. If you want to look at the book and you want to order it, go to her website, drsarahmatt.com. Sarah is spelled with an H. Matt is spelled with two T's, drsarahmatt.com. We'll, of course, kick off the entire episode with our Newmarkers newsmakers. Chris Newmarker, the editor of Mass Device, and I will unpack the stories of the week. So lots coming your way in this episode of Device Talks Weekly. Thanks for being a part of it. This is our third to last episode coming out in 2025. We'll have another one for you next week, an entire episode focused on Medtronic's Hugo Rass. And then we'll end the year of, we'll end 2025 with a wrap-up episode. The editorial team will get together with the MedTech leader, and we'll unpack our choices for the biggest stories, the biggest individuals or companies, and the most impressive technologies of 2025. So make sure you subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss a future episode. All right, let's get this podcast started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Newmarker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well.
Hey, Chris. I went down to Boston today. Visited the Menino Convention and Exhibition Center. For folks, if you're getting our marketing email, It's no longer the BCEC. It's the MCEC. The Menino, Thomas Menino Convention and Exhibition
Center. Named it after the former mayor.
Former mayor. Yes. Yes.
There you go.
Yeah. I mean, I like the Boston Convention Exhibition Center. You know, you're a mayor, you get shit stuff named after you.
yeah, you know, it's okay, Tom. You could say the S-H-I-T word.
You didn't say it. You spelled it, tough guy.
I still remember one time in the 90s, I was down on Cleveland's waterfront, and they had some little monument to he was a U.S. senator at the time, George Voinovich, and said the greatest mayor in Cleveland's history. Wow. Oversaw Cleveland's renaissance. I'm like, wow, you get some words like that. I might be not remembering it right, but I thought it was very flattering for a politician who was still on this mortal plane to get that kind of language.
I like to think we are the greatest hosts ever of the Device Talks Weekly podcast.
I think so.
Yeah, I think it's indisputable. Exactly. I'd love to find someone to challenge that claim.
Oversaw the medtech industry's renaissance. It'd be fun, right.
Ushered in of artificial intelligence and robotics unparalleled in its... Yeah, that's us.
I'm trying to think of AI type phrases to throw in here now. It's not, they weren't just the, but they were.
So the Device Talks Boston will be at the Menino Convention Exhibition Center on May 27th and 28th. So went down, checked out the space. looks the same like the last time we checked it out, but when we get down there, May 27th, 28th, the inside part will look a lot different. All the speakers will be different. You and I will be the same, but and we'll have a lot of the same attendees, but a lot more new ones, I bet, too.
Huge convention center, and you know, Device Talks Boston has grown into a huge show. I just feel so honored to be part of this and see what it's become, and it's going to be exciting to see the show next year.
Very excited, and folks should know that I think the Red Sox are in town that week as well. Nice. So folks can catch a little baseball while they're here. All right, Chris Newmarker, we've got some news this week.
You betcha.
Why don't we open up the can of Newmarker's newsmakers on these people?
I'll opening it up actually with some Minnesota news. We got Maple Grove, Minnesota-based Francis Medical, privately held, got their 510K clearance for their Vanquish water vapor ablation system that can be used for managing prostate cancer. The indication is specifically for prostate tissue ablation, but this is like a transurethral ultrasound and electromagnetically guided thermal water vapor device. So just really cool to see a new option out there for prostate cancer treatment.
And they had raised $80 million earlier this year. You wrote the article you're citing. Sean Hooley wrote this other article, raising money from Orlando Health Ventures and Arboretum Ventures and Solis Bio Ventures. So, got some great investors behind the company as well. So
yeah, fantastic. Yeah, it'll be fun to keep on following this company, which is in the neighboring town of Maple Grove from where I'm based. So that's pretty cool.
You know what? Maybe I'll see what they're doing on May 4th when we have Device Talks Minnesota. Maybe they want to come on down and share their story there. So
actually, that would be fantastic. Yeah, they're definitely getting some buzz around the Twin Cities.
Absolutely. All right, let's roll on to number four.
Next one, we've got number four. This is by Sean Hooley, and this is artificial intelligence related. We can't really go a day by on Mass Device when it doesn't seem that we have something that is AI enabled. And this is AI enabled personalized CPAP therapy from ResMed. They got an FDA clearance for their smart comfort personalized therapy offering with their CPAP devices.
It says Smart Comfort uses the company's proprietary machine learning algorithms, drawing on more than 100 million nights of real-world sleep data, and it uses de-identified information like age, gender, apnea, hypopnea index to recommend individualized settings. Well, that'd be good. I'd like a recommendation. Because I'm an idiot when it comes to that kind of stuff. I'd like to know.
Yeah, like how do I set this device? I like to have it saying, like, you might want to have it this way. This is fantastic.
Yeah, for sure. So, all right. Well,
absolutely.
Well, great news from ResMed, taking us down to sunny San Diego, California. Number three is interesting because we had the huge Hugo news last week, and now we have another big surgical robotics story.
Yeah, now we've got SS Innovations submitting for a 510K for their Mantra surgical robot. And I know SS Innovations, they've got, headquarters in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, but a lot of roots in India. They've been getting a lot of buzz. I mean, I remember when you were doing a good surgical robotics conversation with Joe Mullen and Steve Bell, months ago. I mean, this is one of the companies they really mentioned as, one they were really watching in the space that could, they could come in here and do something. So, just even more competition in, soft tissue surgical robotics in the United States, if they win this clearance.
Yep, we had Dr. Vishwa Srivastava, the CEO of APAC for SS Innovations, on the podcast on October 24th. Of course, I met with them when I was at SRS last year, and they're definitely a pioneer or trailblazer or assign whatever name you want to sort of telesurgery and to long distance surgery. They're doing a lot of work there, and certainly taking trying to take some OUS market share from Intuitive and others with a lower cost robot and a modular system. So it's interesting that they're seeking FDA approval. So they have a similar design to Hugo, where they have multiple arms or single arms on multiple rolling units. So more of a modular design. And they have the 3D glasses, which I know was something that Hugo, you had actually had a conversation, and we'll run it next week, with Dr. Porter, right? The CMO of robotic surgery at Medtronic.
Yeah, James Porter over there. And they kind of did the same thing with Hugo, having like kind of like 3D glasses, with an open console.
Open architecture,
design.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Like to try to get away from, you know, with the Da Vinci robots, you've really got that console where you're like just in there, with the headset. So yep. to have kind of that open design is interesting too. And I wonder if how much, you know, SS Innovations mantra could really get involved in this whole ambulatory surgery space that's just like really growing in the United States. So there could be a lot of potential there.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be a focus. I mean, they're looking, so they submitted FDA approval for a range of indications, according to Sean, including urological, colorectal, gynecological, and cardiac surgery. Wow. Hugo, of course, got approval for urological. So it'll be interesting to see, because I guess you could see them having comparable robotic systems. But what Medtronic has is already a pretty solid hold on the surgery market, at least one of the two companies with a really solid hold on the market. So it'll be interesting to see how they, if they were to get FDA approval, how they would fare on the open market. So you talked with Dr. Porter. I spoke with Rajit Kamal, who leads the Medtronic surgical robotics effort. And we'll have that next week on Device Talks Weekly. We have a whole Hugo episode.
Whole Hugo episode. Just really, really something just so anticipated in the robotic surgery space to have Medtronic in the market now.
It's really exciting.
It is.
Yeah, it really is. We've been talking about it so long to the point where it almost got to be like we were talking about spring training of baseball. You know, like let's let the games begin. So it's nice to see Medtronic out there. We'll see if they're able to give Intuitive a run for their money, but the space is definitely filling up. So we'll see what happens.
It'll be exciting. So number two on the list. I remember you came here and we were driving around in my antique Corolla around the Twin Cities for a MedTech Nerd Tour. It was like raining cats and dogs. But I remember you were really excited when we pulled up by the construction site in Maple Grove for Boston Scientific's huge facility, like 400,000 square feet that they were building there. And now it's done.
Yeah.
And I had an article. Beautiful facility. And looks like a starship. I mean,
we thought it looked like a Star Destroyer. The way we were looking at it from like the back corner, it was just this long piece of gray. It was very impressive looking. Looks much, much warmer and nicer now that it's done though. It was also cold and rainy when we went to see it. So
it was very cold and very rainy. Boston Scientific was nice enough to share a photo with us of the on a sunny day with cars in the parking lot. And definitely not right now where I have like nearly a foot of snow on my lawn. I don't see any snow.
Do you really?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
The snowpack is on the lawn. The kids are loving the sledding around the house.
God bless you. All right. Well,
yeah, but anyway, so yeah, no wintry scene of it, but you know, the news, is, you know, that I was writing about this week was that Boston Scientific, they bought the facility outright for nearly $189 million from the developer. So they're moved in, it's open, they own it now. You know, it's a big expansion for Boston Scientific here in the Twin Cities, and getting a lot of attention in the local business publications here as well, because this is probably one of the largest real estate deals of the year, to $189 million deal here around the Twin Cities.
It must be nice to see a big building with the name Boston on it. Must make you feel good.
Yeah, especially since it's here. Why isn't it there, Tom?
Lots of reasons, you know. Yeah, we like, you know, I mean, yeah, they like snow a lot more than we do, apparently. But you had quoted that the facility opened in October, and you said it a CBS Minnesota story at the time, noting that the building is partially made of 14,000 cubic yards of concrete weighing 57 million pounds.
Yes.
As heavy as four Eiffel Towers.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Yeah, right? So it's not going anywhere.
So couples, if you're looking for a romantic place to pop yeah, that question, there's four Eiffel Towers over there at Maple Grove, that's Minnesota. Right. You can get down on one knee and propose in front of the Boston Scientific headquarters.
I did see some like really nice glass atrium like places in there when I was like looking around.
Sounds charming.
Actually, I think that's especially when the weather gets nicer, that's actually a good thing for my to-do list next year, is to pop over there and check that out. Like, ask Boston Scientific Media Relations if I can step over and see everything over there. I think that just looks very cool.
I think that should certainly happen. So maybe I'll time our MedTech Nerd Tour and go over there with you. It'd be nice to see that inside.
It'd be a fun visit.
All right,
fantastic.
Chris Newmarker, big number one.
Big number one. I mean, Teleflex was saying they're going to divest some businesses, and now they're moving forward with stuff. They announced actually two deals. They're going to be selling their OEM business, which is really their big contract manufacturing business, actually, for $1.5 billion. And then they're to private equity firms Montague and Kohlberg, and then they're going to the rest of it for $530 million, like acute care and oncology. They're selling to a British-based medical device maker, Endosurgical. It's kind of like this whole trend of divestments we're seeing right now with all these big conglomerates just continues. And we're really seeing Teleflex, which has been this like kind of big name, now it's going to be a number of different companies, really.
Yeah, it's really fascinating how much reshuffling is going on. I mean, Sean broke the story last week about the reorganization at Johnson & Johnson MedTech. Of course, we're seeing other divestitures, and of course, they divested or are divesting to Pucenthes. So really, I don't know. I'm not sure how much, if there's many more companies that can reorganize or divest at this point. I feel like we've kind of worked our way through all the big ones, but it's interesting times. I wonder what's going to happen if interest rates go down, if that will encourage even more deals like this.
Or maybe companies will be, kind of feels like they want to be especially focused on particular businesses. Maybe they think it makes them more nimble in kind of these more uncertain times where it's harder to get financing. You can get the financing, but it costs you because the interest rates are higher. And you've got the tariffs, around, they try to go to really smaller, nimbler companies. Mm-hmm. But, I wonder if actually maybe you'll see more consolidation if the interest rates go down, because all of a sudden you can finance, it'd be interesting to see how this all turns out. It almost seems like over the decades. I mean, I had someone years ago tell me, I was like, wow, look at all these acquisitions going on in consolidation. They're like, oh, it's just all a cycle. Like, they all come together and then they divest. And we're in the divestor cycle right now, it seems.
If you look at the timeline, it's very true. So, back in the 90s, there was a lot of pharma med tech businesses that spun all the med tech out. And we haven't seen the pharma move back into med tech, but certainly you're seeing med tech go through, acquisition cycles and divestiture cycles. And we seem to be in the latter. So, all right.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe we'll be writing about Medtronic Health and Ears in 10 years.
There you go. Chris Newmarker, where can folks find all this great news and more?
Oh, you can go over to Mass Device. We're covering the news every day, and if you want to really get a nice collection of the top stories of the day in your inbox, sign up for a daily newsletter at Mass Device.
Absolutely. And next week, hopefully, we'll be talking a little bit more about your most recent report from Mass Device on surgical robotics. It's a pretty hot topic. Yep.
Yeah, that's. I know, right? We keep on. There's always like top news on this. So yeah, that'll be a good conversation next week. So fantastic.
All right. Well, enjoy the snow, Chris Newmarker. All right, Chris Newmarker. Thanks for this week's Newmarker's Newsmakers. Now let's hear a message from our sponsor, Lydium Medical.
Jose Maeso, Chief Technology Officer for Lydium Medical. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Caitlin.
So, Jose, there's a lot of reasons why I wanted to sit down with you today. I wanted to know more about Lydium Medical, and I wanted to know from you specifically your experience in nitinol. As I understand it, you're quite the expert.
Well, I'm a Nitinol super user. I've been using Nitinol in my career plentiful. So from being on the OEM side, actually designing and manufacturing parts using Nitinol, now to be on the other end, on the contract manufacturing side, manufacturing and processing Nitinol parts for a customer. So this is becoming full circle. So I'm super glad that we're talking about Nitinol on this talk, because obviously I love Nitinol. So sharing with you, it will be awesome.
I want to better understand Lydia Medical. Just a little bit of history for our audience. It's been about a year now since the merger of Medical Device Components and Lydium, and then you just recently completed a rebranding to Lydium Medical. So that said, can you tell us about the quote-unquote new Lydium Medical?
Yes, Caitlin. Yeah, we wanted to bring together the experience of precision manufacturing with the white glove service that Lydium bring. So the precision manufacturing and heavy scale that all Johnson Matty and MDC brought to the table with the white glove service and just open book processing that Lydium LCC was known for. Now we have both things combined. We have the heavy manufacturing and scale with the nimbleness and be an extension of our customers' engineering resources, basically.
Well, it definitely sounds like two powerhouses coming together. So congratulations on that merger. Congratulations on the rebranding. To sort of fill it out a little bit more, Jose, how does Lydium Medical work with medical device companies?
We do precious metal and Nitinol, but since we're talking about Nitinol, let's keep the subject Nitinol-wise. So we will help the customer decide in the type of Nitinol, right? It will either will be Nitinol sheet or Nitinol tube. Also, we are one of the only companies that are material agnostic on the gun drilling and the ingot. So we can get that ingot from our three different sources, depending on what the customer wants. But then what we'll do is that we will do the drawing of this ingot in-house in Mexicali. Then after we do the drawing and we settle the mechanical specs of that material, then we will transfer it to our sites at Oceanside and San Diego to do the actual microprocessing with lasers, heat treatment, and electropolish, which is going to be like 90% of what the processing needed for a Nitinol super elastic part. So basically, we work hand-to-hand with our customers, both on the raw material side and the processing side for their applications. For the precious metal, we do the same type of considerations. We do a lot of platinum iridium and platinum alloys, especially for radiopacity inside of the body. And a lot of times they go hand to hand with Nitinol, because Nitinol, even though it's a magic metal, it's not that much radiopaque. So we will add radio markers in order for the doctor or the physician to know where the part is located inside the body via x-rays.
We'll hear a little more from Lydium Medical a little later in the podcast. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, you can go to their website, lydium.com. That's lydium.com. Now it's time for our FOMO interview with between Caitlin Brown and Dr. Sarah Matt. This was recorded at Device Talks West. Let's listen.
Dr. Sarah Matt, professor and serial entrepreneur and author of The Borderless Healthcare Revolution. Welcome to the Future of MedTech Opportunities.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Caitlin.
I have had you on our FOMO series before, and I will have you again if you'll so allow.
I absolutely will.
Yes. Sold. So today, I really want to talk through connected health. I know you have a lot of experience, but can you share like what brought you into connected health, what experience you have, like catch us up.
Sure. So, you know, I'm a surgeon by training, my fellowship's in burns, and I felt very, I'd say, constrained at the bedside, and that's why I moved into med tech. And so my entire career, I've been building out product development and strategy teams all over the world, everything from digital health solutions, so next-gen healthcare, all the electronic medical records people love to hate. And then at Oracle, I was there driving their platform infrastructure business for OCI globally, so cloud for healthcare and life sciences, which, again, I think from a connected perspective, it was during the days where Oracle was really a black horse in the cloud market, and people were trying to get off-prem. Folks were really considering how they could use more connectivity. And then I got to help Oracle acquire Cerner. So that was their largest acquisition in history. And bringing that entire portfolio into the fold was really exciting, really brought everything to the forefront, but also all the problems that still are here. So last year, you may have seen me at Boston Device Talks as the Chief Strategy Officer at Savato. They're doing great work in remote robotic surgery. But right now, I'm here on my book tour for the Borderless Healthcare Revolution. So I have built, I have implemented, I have driven strategy for so many connected health ideas, devices, et cetera.
I don't think that you often hear surgeon moved into Oracle. That's not, I think, a resume checklist that they typically search for, but that understanding of what it's like to be in the OR, the patient's need and that experience, that has to be just completely rich in wealth for just like hands-on knowledge for the team. So
absolutely.
Thank you for bettering the ecosystem just with your experience. And then you've been able to touch so many more people.
Yes.
Not to say that you didn't make a huge impact one-on-one, but that's the beauty of the medtech industry. You're impacting millions of people.
Every day, millions.
What a privilege.
It very much is.
So let's talk about challenges. You alluded to a little bit of those challenges. So the challenges when it comes to connected health, what are those today?
Right now, the technology is the easy part.
Interesting.
And I know we're here at Device Talks West. I know that everyone here is deep into it. But what I'd say is that tech is evolving at a rapid pace, and we're going to continue to do so. AI is continuing to move at a rapid pace. Manufacturing is moving at a rapid pace. I'm not worried about the technology. I'm worried about how we're going to actually implement it, produce programs around it, commercialize it properly so that great IP becomes great businesses. And so ultimately, we have to do everything from gain trust from providers and patients to consider financial models and reimbursement, and then ultimately make sure that all these interesting technologies are not just for the haves, but for everybody. So healthcare access is a huge push from me.
I mean, that's, I think, very much in line with your book, Borderless on Healthcare. Excuse me, the Borderless Healthcare Revolution. So you talk a lot about that, and you're absolutely right. And there's two things that I want to unpack here. One, access for all.
Mm-hmm.
And the second here is that ultimately it's still a business.
Absolutely.
So if it isn't reimbursable, if we're not going to be able to pay for it, then it's not going to stick. And that's incredibly important. So what needs to fix? Like, what do we need to do as an industry to try to solve those challenges?
So in my book, I really dig this into five pillars. So the five pillars of access are financial, trust and knowledge, cultural, digital, and financial. And so if you look at all these pieces, I mean, we have tons of system engineers that are here at this conference. It's a system level view. Any problem you have in medtech, if you look at those pieces when you're implementing or trying to figure out your commercialization strategy, that's the audit you need to do. So when we think about how we're going to get things reimbursed, how we're going to get these into the hands of folks, I think that a lot of startups in particular will use all of their resources on development. Oh, we have to get that prototype done. And absolutely, you need to get that prototype done. However, your commercialization strategy, how you're going to get it paid for, the reimbursement pieces, and again, that can be from country to country, from state to state, you name it, public versus private, those discussions and paths need to be built out when you're building the business case. And just like I mentioned before, this is the difference between having a cool solution and having a real business that's scalable and is going to make the impact that you're looking for.
I think you were saying all the keywords to the business side of our attendees at Device Talk.
Yes.
Like, that's so important. Have we made any progress today, like toward what we're talking about?
I think we have. One of the speakers today mentioned competition, and I think that's vitally important. So the more competition we have in the space, the more different organizations that are pushing forth new advances, new ways of doing things, I think that's best. Because ultimately, then we have all these different organizations working towards reimbursement, working with the societies, working with different ministries of health. And I think that if we have only one, it's not going to be as effective. If we have lots of folks saying, hey, we have tons of usage here, we know we need to get this out to the people, how can we do it? And there's all those groups doing it, then people start listening.
Makes a lot of sense. Do you have any maybe specific technological or technology advancements that might help support what we're talking about?
So when I think about soft tissue robotics, I mean, there's so much going on in that space. We have some really big players, but there's also lots of smaller players all over the world. And so when we see some of the keynotes for tomorrow as an example on remote robotic surgery and the work from Intuitive as an example, man, there's great work there. And we are so close to doing this at scale. But if we only had one organization doing that, pushing the FDA, pushing other organizations throughout the world, we would just have one. And so I really appreciate that the virtual incisions of the world, the J&Js, the smaller guys, there's so many great Japanese and South Korean companies that are really pushing in remote robotics right now. Those are the ways we have new innovation, new architecture, and new ways to reimburse. Because I don't know if you know this, but if I did a lap chole today, so laparoscopic cholecystectomy, removing a gallbladder, it's the same codes if you do it laparoscopically or with a robot. You don't get paid anymore.
Then what's the incentive?
Well, right now, providers are actually demanding the use of robots because it's better for them. They're not standing all day and the outcomes tend to be better. So new papers that are coming out are showing improved outcomes, less pain, things like that. But they're actually not getting reimbursed more.
I'm just going to let that sit for a second.
I know, right? We could have an entire series on that one.
I'm going to have you back and we're going to talk about that more. Let's take it into the, when we think about connected health, what do we think connected health is today and what could it be in the future?
So I'd say that today, connected health has no real borders. So we have everything from the wearables that I'm covered in right now or everyone has in their pocket. And then we have therapeutics that are absolutely prescribed. We have the devices that we have the big players putting and implanting. But, you know, there's all sorts of pieces. What is connected? Is it your phone? Is that connected health? I don't think we have a really good definition. But what I would say about it is that here I am, I've got my Aura ring on. I'm testing out the Apollo right now. We'll see if that works. I have my cell phone. You have multiple devices on you. And we're super privileged. I have the ability to buy these wellness devices out of pocket. But the folks that may need them most may not have the extra funding to go this direction. And we're actually seeing a lot of connected health companies go the direction of wellness because there's less regulation from an FDA perspective. There's less oversight. They don't have to get things through a reimbursement model. They're going straight to consumer. However, like we just mentioned, from an access perspective, this leaves out a huge population.
In like a 30-second or less sort of wrap up, what could the future connected health look like if these problems are solved in a perfect world? What could it look like 10 years from now?
10 years is way too long to think about. I think 12 months is probably as far ahead as we can even consider
Let's do it now.
But I'm going to name drop Dexcom right now because they're working on glucose monitoring and the ability to use pumps, et cetera, for the consumer. But it's also a prescribed and covered entity. And so I think that we're going to find ways to assist with chronic disease like diabetes, find ways to have it prescribed and covered, but also have those wellness elements that give insights to the actual patient and user here and now in real time. And I think that's the best of all worlds. And ultimately, I'm hoping that we can go that direction with other technologies.
Well, Dr. Sarah Matt, I've loved every second with you. I'm going to definitely have you back on. How can our audience find you?
Sure. So my book is called The Borderless Healthcare Revolution. Everyone can go to drsarahmatt.com. Learn all about me and what I've been up to, but also learn more about the book. The first chapter is actually available right now.
Well, I've already read it. Dr. Sarah Matt, thank you so much again for joining us.
Absolutely.
All right. Once again, go to drsarahmatt.com. Sarah has an H in it. Matt has two T's. drsarahmatt.com to get your copy of The Borderless Healthcare Revolution. Now it's time for my conversation with Ray Cohen. Once again, as I mentioned up top, Ray Cohen is a highly successful medtech entrepreneur, most notably sold Axonix to Boston Scientific for just under $4 billion. We'll unpack his playbook in this conversation. He'll give some concrete instructions as to what you do and what you don't do to build and exit a medtech successfully. So happy to bring you this conversation with Ray Cohen. Ray, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate being here. It's been a really great conference.
Great. I'm glad. I know. I saw you up here yesterday. So let's talk about you've had great success building and selling companies. Axonix is the
biggest and most recent, but you've been involved with the sale of Sanofi and others before that as well. Vessix Vascular, you're a fellow renal denervation nerd like I am. We both enjoy the space. So I want to sort of just take a look inside your med tech brain and sort of understand how you see these opportunities. You're having, again, great success in turning ideas into companies and finding them a great home in the corporate world. So you talk about finding gaps. Do all gaps share sort of the same qualities and check the same boxes when you see a gap? Is a gap a unique opportunity, or do they share things in common?
So I think that for early stage companies or startups, right, when they're first getting started, I think they need to really understand this thing that I've got, this widget, as it might be, is it incremental based on, you know, what exists? You know, so something nice that improves on the existing product. One has to ask themselves, is that a company? Mm-hmm. Or is that just an incremental improvement, and really one should be talking to the owner or owners of the market share players who have, you know, that base technology, mm-hmm. right? And I think sometimes people get a bit confused about that. If you're going to start a company and you're going to look to capitalize that company and do everything that's involved in that, that's a lot involved and a long road ahead. And you need to really look at what is the total addressable market. Is it big enough that you're going to be able to attract the investment capital that you need? Because if it isn't a big enough opportunity, you're not going to get the money. And all roads lead back to capital. If you don't have the capital, you can't bring the people that you need, right? Smart people don't work for free. Mm-hmm. They may work more for paper or equity than they would for cash in the beginning, and that's fine. But the point is, you got to bring the people. If you don't have the capital, you can't bring the people. If you don't have the people, you can't get the job done. So I think it all goes down to, is the deal financeable? Mm-hmm. Right? That's the first question that one has to ask.
Is the market size the thing that determines that?
Market size is the biggest single thing.
Yeah.
Because if I'm going to plow money into something, I want to see that it's a big enough opportunity, mm-hmm. that it makes sense. That in the end, my return on investment from the investor side is going to be big enough and worthwhile to be involved in that journey.
Is there a number like this needs to be 100 million? This needs to be 200 million, or does it really depend?
Yes, of course it depends. And there's nobody's raising any capital with a $100 million TAM. I mean, that is not going to happen. You're not going to raise any money. Yeah, you can maybe raise it from orphans and widows, okay?
Yep.
Sorry, I don't mean to be rude, but,
yep.
So people think, oh, I got some friends and family and, you know, involved and, you know, I'm ready to go. Well, okay, it's going to take millions and millions and millions, probably tens of millions, and, you know, to get the thing off the ground. So total addressable market is number one. And the other thing that when I talk to entrepreneurs, I'm like, do yourself a favor. Whoever told you that you're supposed to put some sort of hockey stick chart in the back of your deck, you know, that shows how you this thing is going to grow like a weed, drop that, okay? That's not what, and no one believes it. They're just going to toss that in the garbage. You're losing credibility immediately. Talk about what is the total addressable market? How many people are afflicted with this particular problem? You know, why is it that we believe our technology is going to be able to access those individuals, mm-hmm. and provide them with a better quality of life or whatever the case might be?
We had a conversation here yesterday. Kayleen talked to Josh Macauer at Stanford, mm. and reimbursement was a huge part of that conversation,
yep.
and its impact on startups. And we actually continued the conversation this morning next door at the Women in MedTech breakfast. At that early stage, what level of understanding of the reimbursable market do you need to have? Do you need to know 100% where you're headed, what you're going to be able to get? Do you need to have a vague notion of what's going to be available to you? Do you even have a chance of projecting that, because you're not going to be in the market for maybe 4 to 5 years and things may be completely different then?
So, this is an important topic, but let's play it out. If I raise the capital, I build the team, I produce the product, I do my animal experiment, I go to clinic, everything is going great, okay? Now I'm going to commercialize. I mean, this is a rare story I'm telling now, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, now you've commercialized the product. Well, guess what? you got FDA approval, you're going to get CMS to cover your product, but the privates are not going to cover. And now you're, now we talk about reimbursement. If it's a white space opportunity and there's no existing code, well, you got some things to work on before you even get, you know, Medicare to cover, right? CMS to cover. So now hopefully maybe Congress will, if they ever do anything, will vote on you get breakthrough designation and immediately, you know, you've got some sort of coverage. But to get commercial coverage, this is a, you know, pick a 2 to 4 year journey, all right? Because in private insurance companies, they don't want to pay for anything.
Yeah.
They don't even want to pay for whatever it is you're supposed to be paying for because you're covered by them, right? So they don't want to pay for anything. So anything new, they're going to put you through the paces. You're going to have a couple of published clinical studies. You're going to have an economic analysis. I mean, that is a huge undertaking. So when you're considering what is this project I'm involved in, one has to think about, am I going to be a fast follower? And I don't mean fast in terms of, oh, you just came out with a product and I'm coming out 3 months later. I mean, if you're going to be a follower, and there's existing reimbursement codes, and you've got a better mousetrap, and you can do a better job in the market and compete with whatever else is in there, okay, you got a better project. If it's a big TAM and there's a reimbursement code already, you're going to find capital a lot easier than if it's a white space opportunity, even though it may be a spectacular opportunity, but no codes exist, and you're going to have to plow that field. That is a long project that is fraught with peril. And if you've noticed, Tom, in my career, I've tried to find the gaps in terms of where, what products are deficient with existing markets. There's an existing market. There's an existing code. I got a better product, and you know, on and on and on, right? So that is a lane, right? So you have to really understand, what lane am I going down? Am I going down the white space opportunity lane? That is a lifetime project. Right, I mean, meaning they never happen in less than 10 years, okay? Or am I going in a direction where there's an existing market, existing reimbursement, and I'm gonna put a team together, we're gonna build a better product, and we're gonna go out there and compete in the marketplace. And then, you know, the other thing I've done is I look and see who's got a monopoly. If you got a monopoly, man, I'm focused on what you're up to. You know, because you don't have any competition, and that means your people are soft, and they're selling product based on the fact there's no other option, okay? So there are these things that one needs to think about. And the last point I would make, since you're asking me how do you pick projects and all that, okay, is who's gonna buy it? Who's gonna buy this product? I shouldn't have said it. Who's gonna buy the company, right? If you don't have an idea of who the potential buyers are, then you're not ready to go pitch to anybody, because that's a question that's gonna get asked right up front. Who's going to buy this? When are they going to buy it? Does it need to have commercial traction to be able to have a buyer? Do you just need to show good clinical results? So this is important. You need to understand that in advance, because that's the questions that you're going to get asked. Now, I've been aware of that, of course, as being somebody in the industry, on industry side, you know, pitching deals for, you know, 40 years. But now that I'm a venture partner, you know, I'm living that also, right? And it comes up early in the first meeting. And, you know, if you're pitching a venture fund and somebody doesn't say, so who are the likely buyers? And you don't have a damn good story associated with that, and it's not, and it's real, then you're not going to get very far with that firm.
So when you're looking at those, it's interesting. You're looking for those opportunities with big markets, but you're warning against going into those open fields where there's no reimbursement infrastructure currently. So you really do have to, seem like the only plausible gap for following your strategy is to create a company that's the better mousetrap, and then it's going to go against one company that's sort of dominating the field. Like you're charging at directly at the dragons. You're going directly at the giants. Is that right?
The case study is Exonix.
Yeah, and we'll get that.
You know, but that's just the case study, and there are others. And when I say just because there's a monopoly, you need to compare that against what is the TAM, what is the addressable market. There are some products that are out there that they may not have no other players, but they are doing $100 million in revenue, and the total market's not much bigger than that. Well, that's not a project that you're going to attract a lot of capital for, if you know what I'm saying.
Okay.
Unless, of course, you're a European-based company, because they have such a paucity of deals.
you know, to invest in. Sometimes yeah. they'll invest in deals that are, you know, smaller ball than the you know, let's say the larger venture fund.
Gotcha. So we'll focus on Exonics in a moment. But as you're again looking at starting a company, what are three immediate things you need to have in place to move forward and pursue an opportunity? In terms of like co-founders, IP, capital, what do you need to have? What boxes do you need to check before you set sail?
Look, everybody needs some IP. You know, the fact of the matter is you need IP. Venture investors won't invest unless you have some issued patents, or at least they're down the path. And then, of course, nobody wants you to do anything with them, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the irony of all that. Like, you get these patents, but God forbid, you know, you were to assert them against anybody, because there's no venture fund in the world that wants to spend their money on that. Repeat the question again.
The things you need to have to start a company.
Okay.
You have IP,
okay.
Capital sources.
Okay, so IP is one thing. Okay, people are not going to. Freedom to operate is more important than actually an issued patent. So you need to do your FTO analysis. You need to have freedom to operate.
That means you're not conflicting with anyone else's.
That is the key.
Yeah.
Right? When we talk about intellectual property, it's more like, do you have the freedom to practice your invention? Have you done the work? Is it in writing? Have you gotten a legitimate firm, you know, to write you an opinion about that? Some people like opinions in the file, some don't, but that's debatable. But the point is, you have to do that work. Okay, so I got to have freedom to operate. Mm-hmm. Okay, before you start spending money, you better know that, right? The other thing is, who's getting money? Well, people who've done it before. I hate to say it, but, you know, it's harder if you're a first-time CEO, or if you don't have a team that you've put together that has, you know, the scars on their back and the notches in the belt. I don't know what to say about it, but it's just reality, right? So money likes to flow to people who've done it before. So how do you mitigate that? If I'm a first timer and I have never transacted a deal before, or grew a company and created a successful exit, okay, or an IPO or whatever the case might be, then you better find some advisors or some board members, you know, that have a little bit of gray hair and have a track record, because they can help you. And that seems to be what I'm up to these days, right? So, you know, I've moved from an operating guy to a guy who sits on boards to help companies access capital, get the strategy, you know, right, and then go from there, right? And figure out, dude, is this something we really want to commercialize or not? Because I believe the best time to sell a company is before you ship the first commercial product. Mm. If you've got nothing else and no other reason to be in that market, then, man, do your work, do it really well, and see if you can't get this thing sold. Because once you cross that Rubicon and you're going to commercialize, boy, that's a big money game. And I think the mistake that people make and the bad advice that they get is, oh, why don't you just hire 6 people, go out and see how it goes. Mm-hmm. You know what the answer to that is? Here's how it's going to go. You're just going to prove that adoption is hard and that you didn't light up the scoreboard. That's the only thing you're going to prove. Now the bloom is off the rose. So you actually screwed it all up. And who gave you that advice? Probably the venture capital people at the board. Because, oh, they don't want you to risk the money. Okay? Mm-hmm. But that's the wrong strategy. And if you're going to market, if you're going to go and get involved in a gunfight, don't bring a knife. Mm-hmm. Okay? Bring a bazooka. Right? And that's defined as people and a field team and so on and so on and so forth.
We're going to take a really quick break from our conversation with Ray Cohen to bring you the conclusion of my conversation with this episode's sponsor, Lydium Medical. Well, Jose, you did say that you're an open book, so I don't usually get the opportunity to ask a follow-up question. What do you think sets Lydium Medical apart from others in the industry?
Yeah, funny that you mentioned the open book, because a lot of the comments that we get from customers when they come and visit us for the first time is like, wow, you're going to let me in front of the process, see the lasers, see the heat settings, see electropolishing? And our first answer is yes, when we're so open that we will just bring engineers here to their site. We'll ask them to bring their Tortoise model or anything they can test their parts right away. So we will interact in the fly with them, right? So first, they make the first piece. For example, they, you know, we heat set it with certain temperature. So they give us the feedback, hey, we want the part to be felt softer or harder. We can either change the AF on that natural device in order to make it conform or feel completely different, or change the cutting path, or change the electro polishing. So the sky's the limit. When we say we're open book, we mean it. We love customers to come here, educate them, and we just feel that the relationship just grows from that regard so strong. Then we're just, you know, we're not a vendor to them anymore. So we love it.
Before I let you go, as I understand it, you will be at MD&M West. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, it is.
If you'd like to book a meeting to meet with the team at booth number 2422, please follow the link that I've just dropped in our show notes, and that will help you book that meeting directly. Beyond that, if you want to know about your laser mapping processing expert, please visit their website at www.ligheteum.com, LIGHTEUM.com. Jose Maeso, Chief Technology Officer, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I thoroughly enjoyed my time with you.
Anytime, Kathleen, anytime. I enjoy it too.
Once again, a huge thank you to Ligheteum Medical for supporting this episode of Device Talks Weekly. If you want to get to know your laser mapping processing expert, please visit their website at www.ligheteum.com, LIGHTEUM.com. And don't forget to meet them in person at the upcoming MD&M West conference in booth 2422. If you want to book a meeting directly with the team, please follow the link in the show notes. Thank you again so much. And now we bring you the conclusion of our conversation with Ray Cohen, former Exonix CEO and successful MedTech serial entrepreneur.
Is the thing that keeps people from maybe selling at that point the notion that they started this product, this company, that this is their dream and they want to get it into the hands of, does romance of medtech sort of blind people to that?
If you've got some romantic idea that you want to run this business and that's fine. Okay, good for you. But that's not the big game that we're playing here.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, how do people keep score? Okay, exits.
Yep.
Return of investment on capital that is deployed. And as the Godfather used to say, you got to make money for your partners.
And just final question on this part, and then we'll open up to a couple of questions. Clinical supporters, do you need to have a doctor champion at the start, or do you get those later on when you've got a product? Like, do you need some clinical validation from clinicals, not clinical trials, but clinicians?
Yeah, of course. I mean, look, physicians are a big part of the game from the beginning. I mean, you know, we learn about gaps. We do all kinds of stuff by talking to physicians.
Yeah.
You know, you always want to have a couple on your team that are going to speak positively about whatever you're up to, about the promise of the technology, or explain in a clinical way why this fits and how it's going to be useful and why they might want to use it. But don't make the mistake of giving equity to physicians. You cannot have a physician advisor who is a shareholder in your company, because that's, the credibility is out the door, because now they're conflicted. And this is another mistake that I see people make. You know, oh, we don't have money, so I'm going to give shares to this doctor. Well, you just blew it.
Yeah.
Okay? Because they're conflicted. And whoever is going to be calling to do their diligence is going to have to be disclosed. And I'm not talking about I'm on a panel and I flip up that slide and it shows my 17 different consulting arrangements for 30 seconds and nobody ever sees it. I'm talking about, think about who is going to, when I'm involved in diligence and you're going to call some physicians, okay, you need to think about who are they going to call. Yeah, sure, they'll speak to your two advisors or whatever it is, but they're going to call the other players in the business and they're going to ask their opinion. So you've got to do stuff to create exposure so a broader audience of I'll call them KOLs for lack of better terminology, are aware of what you're doing. You've got to get out there and let people know what you're up to, because you got to think about who's going to be making those phone calls, who are they going to call? And I want to be able to talk to those physicians, mm-hmm. and I want to get them to understand what we're doing, why we're doing it, and why it's a great idea, so that when that phone call comes, they go, oh yeah, I talked to Ray, and you know, this looks really great, and here's how I'd use it, and I think it's a big opportunity, blah, blah, blah. But as an honest broker, as a fair broker.
Yep. Okay?
And I'm not talking about, you know, you're going to give somebody an honorarium for being at some event. That's normal.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Nobody cares about that.
Okay. I'm going to move on to Axonics' story. If we have any questions from the audience, Kayleen has a microphone, or I can just continue going on up here. But if anyone had a precise question about what we're talking about at the moment, love to have it. Okay, great. We're doing a good job then. Let's talk about Axonics kind of as a case study to illustrate what we're talking about here. Talk us through the founding story of Axonics. How did you come upon the idea? And we'll like to get into sort of how you saw a successful path forward.
So, you know, look, this is one of these stories, right? You could go on for 2 days to tell the story, but I was at a conference just like this, Tom.
See, it can happen to you, yeah.
Okay, no, I was at a conference, and I had just done a transaction where we created a renal denervation product, mm-hmm. Kind of restarted a company that was failed and created a product, ran the clinical study, and then sold it in 18 months with only $24 million in the deal and got $225 million out the door. Okay,
I feel so like we could have a whole different conversation on a restart of companies like that.
That's a good one, too. Yeah. I like that. Yeah. I like the broken company with some technology and you can get in and so forth. So I was telling the story of Vessix Vascular.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and people said to me, so cool, Ray, great, blah, blah, blah. What's next? And I go, this is 2013. I said, I'm totally geeked up about neurostimulation. I believe neurostimulation or neuromodulation is a technology whose time has come. And we are just seeing the tip of the iceberg. And I said, I believe that over the next decade or so, you're going to see neurostimulation being used widely on all kinds of clinical conditions in the body. And this is truly amazing. The body electric is the new wave.
Do you know why you saw that then? Because neurostimulation had been around forever, and we were all felt like at that point, we were like, this is it. This is when things are going to start to take off, and you were right in this regard.
I mean, sometimes you just got to go with your gut, right?
Yep.
And, I'm very fortunate that, I have a lot of contacts in the business. I read all the analyst reports. I know a lot of analysts. They're always digging in the dirt, right, and, you know, writing about stuff. So, you know, I was informed, right, to a large extent. But I'm talking about it. I could have been wrong with, I was just making a projection. So at the end of that conference, at the end of that talk, somebody came up to me and said, oh, Ray, you're interested in neurostimulation. Oh, by the way, we've been playing around with some stuff. We got this little thing, an enclosure with ceramic, and you might want to take a look at it. I'm like, sure. And that was the genesis of the project.
Wow.
Literally, if I hadn't volunteered 4-0, right, to come and speak, I would have not had somebody come up to me, and that gave us the impetus to get the project started. We licensed an enclosure, just an enclosure, titanium and ceramic together, which would facilitate a small implantable device mm-hmm. that you could recharge through the ceramic window efficiently. I'm like, okay, great. We started the company. And then it was a question of what the hell are we going to do with this? I had no preconceived notion that we were going to go to treat a urinary incontinence mm-hmm. or urinary urge incontinence. I just went through an exploration at that point to say, okay, I've got something. I'm going to do a neuromodulation project. What am I going to do? And then we started the process of really understanding from a technology standpoint, from a business standpoint, how many competitors, is there a market, is there reimbursement, so on and so forth, and went through this entire journey, probably took 90 days to analyze that, and then kind of came to the conclusion, you know, at the time I was 55, and I'm like, you know what, I'm not going to do a white space deal, because that's going to take forever. I'm not up for that. So when we looked around, you know, I looked at pain, which is kind of obvious. Mm-hmm. It was the big market at the time. And it's like, you know, there are already four competitors or three that were embedded and one coming, which was Nevro, which, you know, went like that and then kind of flamed at the end. Mm-hmm. But still, so I'm like, I don't want to be the fifth man in a four-man race. And people, everybody here, should, if you're involved in a project, you should be thinking about that. Is that the project you want to pick? So as we're looking around and I see, wait a minute, there's this urinary incontinence market called sacral neuromodulation. Medtronic has a monopoly. They've had a monopoly for 20 years. Their product, you know, I wonder how good this product is. And you know, they had a $500 million revenue line and a reimbursement. And I'm like, ooh, wait a minute. Let's look at this product. And then we began the process of, you know, looking at the product and understanding and how could we make something better, live longer, be more efficient, be more efficacious, easier to use, because this is a woman's product. And we just talked about that. Mm-hmm. You know, you had a nice session there. So it was really fun to develop a product specifically going to be used by women and have that as a thought process in the development. So we picked it because I felt that we had a soft underbelly from the competitor. They were fat and happy and you know, they had no other reason to be in urology. This is the only product they had. And then we said, okay, we're going in that direction. And then we went around and started to pitch the deal. We raised $32 million in a Series A and sold 85% of the company.
Really?
85% of the company on day one. Because here's the reality. As a founder, if you can maintain 15% equity for you and your team, that's fantastic. Now, the key is you got to re-green yourself as you continue to raise money along the way. And that's normal. That's normal. Investors need management. Management needs incentives, okay? But don't hold equity because you're worried about dilution. 100% of nothing is nothing, okay? But I can tell you a point or two of a few billion dollars changes your life and the life of your colleagues as well. So, you know, I'm still amazed how many people are, dilution. Like, what are you talking about? Get the money you need, get more money than you think you're going to need, because what are the two constants that I'm sure everybody listening will agree to? Everything takes longer and costs more than you think. Mm-hmm. That's just like the rules of the road.
Did you raise the $32 million because of the idea or because you had sold Vessix Vascular before and you were experienced? I mean, who knows, for sure, but I'm sure they were both part of it. But what do you think?
Look, money, everybody says, oh, it's really hard to raise money. Yeah, it is. But money flows to the best ideas and the best management teams. That's the way it goes.
Yep.
And for the people who've done it before, they have an easier time. I mean, it's just the facts. So back to the earlier comments about getting people involved in your project who have credibility, can lend you the credibility that you need to be able to raise the capital that you need, because without capital, you're not going anywhere. Oh, but I got some grants. Yeah, oh, good, congratulations, $1.5 million. That's great. How long is that gonna last?
Yeah. So. You, the idea you're describing sounds a lot like the final product that you sold to Boston Scientific. We always hear, oh, med techs need to pivot, you need to respond. Did you ever need to pivot? Did you ever need to reposition, or was it a straight line for Axonics?
Not with Axonics. I mean, I think what we did was, you know, as we got into the market, and by the way, just for the record, we took this company public before we had FDA approval and before we had any revenue. Now, that's pretty weird. But unicorn does happen every once in a while. Mm-hmm. But all the other elements were there. It wasn't just because, you know, I'm a good storyteller. I mean, we had the reimbursement. There was a market. We had a soft competitor. We had a better product. Okay? So those elements were there that allowed us to be able to raise the money. I always get lost in my own stories. The question again was?
No, if you ever had a pivot.
Pivoting.
Yeah, if you ever had a pivot.
So once we got into the market, you know, and by the way, okay, we raised the money in an IPO, and people said, well, Ray, what are you going to do? You're still maybe a year away from commercialization. I said, well, I'm going to hire at least 100 people, and I'm going to pay them, salespeople, $20,000 a month to train, and clinical specialists, $10,000 a month to train on a guaranteed basis, and we're going to get these people trained up, and on average, they're going to be with me for 6 to 9 months, and when I wake them up at 3 a.m, they're going to be able to sing the company song. And I'm going to do that. That's what I'm going to do with the proceeds. And some people said, well, you're out of your mind. And I said, well, don't invest. Because that's what we're going to do. Okay? And we did that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we started, we sold $26.5 million in our first full quarter, which wasn't a full quarter because COVID hit. So I only had 2 months. $26.5 million out of the box. And then COVID hit. And then, you know, kind of the world ended for a little bit of time. But we finished that year at $111 plus million in revenue. That's a start, okay? You know, and you could say, oh, you know, I don't know, whatever people say, oh, you're lucky. Well, luck. I did the crazy thing.
Yeah.
I hired all these people. But when the bell rang, man, we were at it hard and so on and so forth. And it's interesting. COVID saved our company. There was so much demand. We couldn't make the damn product fast enough.
Wow.
Okay. I told my team, build me $20 million of the product before the first quarter, right? Build me $20 million. And everybody said, well, Ray, you're out of your mind. I'm like, yeah, this is a constant theme, okay? Build me $20 million, just go do it. Stop questioning it. And it turns out we didn't have enough product. So we were scrambling. We had to run three shifts just to keep up with the demand. Then COVID hit and gave us a break. So we were able then to create three shifts. And during the first 3 months of COVID, when everybody was hiding under their desk, we're building product like mad, like maniacs. So man, when the bell rang again, bam, we were at it. We had plenty of product. We had, you know, we were ready to go. But we had the capital. You see, that is the key. We had the capital. Mm-hmm. You know, we raised the, whatever it was, $130 million.
How did you know? Because this smart guy, Ray Cohen, just told me 10 minutes ago, yeah, don't sell the company before you commercialize.
Well, the point is there was some interest, but I knew this was going to be a big one.
Okay.
And I was not going to sell it on the cheap or on some sort of, you know, earn out nonsense and all the rest. Okay, pivot. You asked me about pivot. We didn't have to pivot, but I tell you what we did do. Once we're out in the market, I realized that the patients that we were dealing with, a lot of them couldn't get to the bathroom in time and would leak. That's what sacral neuromodulation treats. But for a lot of women, they have what's called stress urinary incontinence. I cough, I sneeze, I'm laughing, I pick up an object, I exercise, I leak. It's annoying. It's an annoying problem. And the point is, what was the solution? The solution to that problem is a sling operation, to move your lady parts around and do a surgical intervention. Well, who wants to do that, right? For a problem that's kind of like, kind of annoying, okay? So it was like, ooh, wait a minute. About 40% of my patients have this other problem that we're not addressing.
Mm.
So I'm going to go on. I started to go on the lookout for what could we bring to the party as a second act to be able to get further into the market, treat more patients, and have something my competitor didn't have.
Mm.
And so we wound up doing a deal where we bought a European product called Bulkamid from a Danish company. The total market in the United States at the time we transacted that was $25 million. I paid $225 million for the asset in cash. Everybody said, you're crazy. Who the hell spends $200 million to buy something that's $25 million? I said, no, you don't understand. I know the patients. I know my customers. This is going to go. We had a great product. We did all the diligence and so on. So we brought it on board. It took us, in the end, it took about 4 years to ramp it to $100 million in revenue.
Wow.
At $1,000 a piece. That's 100,000 women in 2024, let's say, and got treated for their stress urinary incontinence. But more importantly, what did it do? It allowed us to get into accounts that were happy with the status quo. All of a sudden, now we show up and it's like, hey, we got something these other guys don't do. Your status quo is one thing, but look what we got here. You want to work with us.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped us sell more product on the other side of the ledger as well. So you've seen it. So it wasn't a pivot, but let's call it an enhancement,
yep.
A second act. And one of the things that I say people who have a one product company and are out there getting some success, think about, what's my second act? How do I supercharge this thing? How do I create something that is, that my competition doesn't have,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And, you know, look, I'm involved on a number of boards. One of the boards I'm involved in is also out of this playbook. It's called Kestra Medical.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wearable defibrillator for patients coming out of the hospital. They wear this thing for 90 days so they don't die of cardiac arrest, okay? Well, they're competing against Zoll. Zoll's got a monopoly. We got a better mousetrap, voila, and we're after it. And the company's doing quite well and is public and went public in March. So, you know, there's a pattern here. If you kind of look at, like, what am I involved in? Why am I involved in it? And you can start to see there is a pattern that has developed.
Absolutely.
Over this period of time.
What was the reimbursement path like for Exonics? Did you have everything?
It was there.
It was all there.
It was there. Ready codes were there. Yep. They were generic codes for sacral neuromodulation.
Okay.
So I didn't have to do any work in that area.
Why the IPO, though? Was it just because it was
money.
Available? Money. Yeah. All right, that'll do it. Yeah, I suppose. But
I want to make a comment. It is 100 times easier to raise money from institutional investors in the public markets in America than to raise venture capital. Okay. 100 times easier. Let me tell you what the diligence is when you pitch. First of all, every meeting is 1 hour. Mm-hmm. Every meeting with a VC starts with 1 hour, and then it goes on for the next 4 months for at least 100 more hours, okay? They're gonna overturn every rock and stone and, make you crazy, right, when you're on the other side. Public markets, they take a 1 hour meeting with you, they make one phone call, and then they make a decision. I'm either buying your stock or I'm not. Nah, man, that's some fast money.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, that's a great way to go. And then once you've raised more than $100 million in venture, it gets very, very difficult to raise more capital because the liquidation preferences stacks starts to get high. That's an issue for management. But also, you know, they can't necessarily own as much as they want to own and on and on. So if you've raised more than $100 million, you know, thinking about public markets makes sense.
Did you have, at this point, you probably did since we talked about possible acquirers in mind. Did you have a list? Let's start moving sort of toward the deal with Boston Scientific. How did that come to be?
Well, once we went public, I never thought about being acquired ever.
Really?
Again. Never thought about it.
You wanted to run this company?
We're public now.
Yep.
The game is get the share price up.
Yep.
Okay, that produce results and go out and keep hammering the market, telling the story, do your IR job, blah, 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 blah. As a public company CEO, if you're not spending at least 30% of your time, a third of your time, talking to institutional investors and the analysts, then you're blowing it. You know, I talked to some CEOs, they went public, and it's like, yeah, I don't really like that part of the job. Well, guess what? You need to resign and get somebody in there that wants to do that.
Did you like it?
I love that part.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I'm here talking to you for free. Okay? So, I would even wear a tie.
I gave you a bottle
of
water,
Ray. I'd even wear a tie. So the point is that it's just a lot easier.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot easier. And then here's the reality: if you perform, you've got the world stage. You've got a platform to talk about your results and to get people excited about it. And then you get that stock moving in the right direction. And then you can, by the way, raise more money now.
Yeah.
Because nobody's going to get, those investors are not going to get diluted. You know, we went public at 15. You know, it was pretty easy to raise a secondary at 22. And then when the stock was at 32, it was pretty easy to raise a third and whatever you would, I don't know what the hell you call that. But, and we just, every time that the stock would continue to move, we just kept raising more money. We overcapitalized this company like crazy. You know, and it's a damn good thing because Medtronic decided that they wanted to slow our roll, so they sued us for patent infringement without any basis, and then put us through. I was just talking to your IP counsel in the audience, and they put us through 5 years of hell. We spent $30 million defending ourselves. It went all the way to a jury trial, an 8-day jury trial of our peers in Los Angeles. And at the end of 8 days, after 1 hour of deliberation, the jury came back and said, yeah, this is all nonsense. Everybody can go home now. Thank you very much. $30 million. Okay? So Medtronic hates the fact that I'm on the speaking bureau these days because I'm going to tell that story. That is bad form. That is nonsense. That you're a big strategic and how you're going to, you're going to throw your weight around by suing people inappropriately for IP. It's nonsense. You know, why didn't they take, because if we spent 30 defending ourselves, what did they spend bringing the case? 50? $50 million is a hell of an R&D budget. Go build something. Sorry.
So you're the CEO of a public company. You like it. You're enjoying the analyst calls.
Yep.
How did Boston Scientific come into this?
We became profitable.
Yep.
Cash flow positive first, and then all of a sudden it's like profitable. I'm like, wow, I was kind of cool. I really wasn't I was like all geeked up about becoming profitable. It's just an inevitable thing. When the revenue line is big enough, you start to, you're doing $400+ million at a margin that's say 75%.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're spending a lot of money in marketing and everything else, you guess what? You're going to start to earn money. So it was interesting. All of a sudden, cash flow positive, then profitable, and then not adjusted EBITDA, but like real profits. And I thought, that's interesting. And then sure as hell, given the revenue line and the fact that the company was could be accretive, voila, a buyer shows up. and made
us. You need more than one?
There's only ever one, by the way.
Okay. Yep.
But in the end, you know, they made us an offer we couldn't refuse. I mean, the stock was, I think, at $58, and they offered 70. I told them it was too little. And we played around and landed at 71, and the deal got done. And, you know, the rest is history. So, I mean, $3.7 billion, that's nothing to sneeze at, right?
It's pretty good.
So,
pretty good. So,
I mean, it isn't Shockwave. Got, you know, congratulations to the Shockwave guys, but, you know, but it's not a bad deal.
So we've got 5 minutes left.
Sure.
I mean, people hear these stories.
Well, wait a minute. You took up 2.5 minutes to talk about your agenda today.
No, okay. Well, we can go. Right. I'll give you those 2.5 minutes back. I have a feeling 5 is not going to be enough anyway. So, people are listening to the story and they're seeing, you know, you give these lessons at the start, this advice at the start, make sure you sell before going public, but then you're the exception to the rule with Exonics. You're an exceptional individual is what I'm saying, and I'm not just complimenting you. I'm saying if you're in the seats and you see someone, oh, sure, he found success, like that wouldn't be as easy for me. What sort of takeaways, what lessons do you give to people to say, no, you can you know, maybe not do this, but you can do something similar? What takeaways do you give to startup entrepreneurs who are looking to start their company, who are listening and maybe taking notes? And
yeah.
What things should they keep in mind going forward?
Well, I mean, it's everything, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, look, first of all, if you're not prepared, you know, one of the things when I'm talking a lot of times, I'll say, you know, how many people here would like to be successful? Raise your hand. Everybody raises their hand.
Yeah.
And then I ask the next question is, how many people are prepared to pay the price? And do you even know what I'm talking about? Because I can tell you that, you know, in the Exonics journey, as an example, I spent 80 hours a week working this, okay? I mean, nonstop, that's your life. You're gonna dedicate your life to this project and you know, on and on. So you gotta be prepared to pay the price. So mm-hmm. I think that's number one. Hard work, there is no replacement for yeah. hard work, good judgment. You know, a lot of people are gonna give you advice. Your job is to figure out, is this good advice or bad advice? That's your job when people are giving you advice, because sometimes bad advice sends you down the river without a paddle, right? And I want to say this. Look, my concept of try to sell the company before you go commercial, I still play that game, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I got involved. I joined the board of Sonovy as the chairman on the night the Exonics deal closed. And then that was in late November. And then by March, I sold the company. I sold them, okay? They were still in starting a pivotal study. So the point is that this can happen. Now, obviously, you know, if you've got connections and people that are, you know, it helps. Of mm-hmm. course, all this helps. So I would just say, go back to, if you haven't done it before, surround yourself with people who have. And then pick their brain and get them involved and so on and so forth. And, you know, folks who have been successful, who've run their own, you know, ice cream store and so on and so forth, what's next for those individuals, right? You get to a certain age, you don't want to start another company and do all this kind of stuff, but they'll serve on your board. They're happy to serve on your board. They're happy to help you. They're happy to share their contacts and so on and so forth. So I think that's the key. You got to really think about, who are my advisors, you know? Because when you are raising venture capital, your board is going to be made up of venture capital investors. Okay, sorry. That's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can squeeze in one or two independent directors. Okay, mm-hmm. But those folks are not exercising their fiduciary duty on behalf of the company. And I don't mean to be rude or inappropriate by saying it that way. They're there representing their firm, their LPs. That's what's going on. So you really need that independent folks. And who are the best? People who've run these types of businesses before. Operators, people who know, you know, their Rolodex is not just a banker and an IP attorney. Okay, right? Their Rolodex is people who sterilize stuff, mm-hmm. People who can help you from a design and development standpoint, on and on and on and on, right? These are the early in the game, these are the contacts that are most important, right? We need to think about market access. Oh, good. Well, hey, here's two people that I've worked with before that can help you in this area. Oh, I need to get smart about reimbursement. Oh, okay, here's some folks that I've worked with before. Here's my opinions, but here's some other experts. You know, you need folks who have a Rolodex that matters. given the stage that you're at, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, people who, you know, were in some large organization or some other thing. And that's the other piece of the puzzle, right? It's folks who've done it from the ground floor have more practical experience for others in early stage projects.
So did you have a phone call that you made to have someone you called during your Exonix time for sounding board, or did you?
But you know, the thing is, by that point, I'd been at it for so many decades it was fine. I mean, I've been very fortunate that, you know, one of the keys to my success has been to find really good people, pay those people well, treat them with respect, give them outsized medical benefits, which means you pay for everything, okay, for them, their family, their prodigy, the whole damn thing.
That's nice.
You know, right? You do those things for people and you engender loyalty. And I have moved that group of individuals along over close to three decades. And my team is always familiar. These are folks I've worked with before. I know them. They have real hard skills. They're all pointy individuals. In other words, they're experts in one thing. Mm-hmm. And then you bring that group together so that you make that beautiful circle. You don't need generalists. I'm the generalist. I need experts, right? So getting good people, keeping them close to you, treating them well, sharing the wealth, okay? Making sure that people have equity, that's the key. And I'll tell you, anybody who's been involved with me over these years, they've learned a very important lesson. They can make money in salary, right? They're good people. Where do you actually pile up some chips? Equity. Equity and exits, or equity and IPOs. So that's the lesson for people who are willing to take a little bit of risk, not much. Because if you think that working for a large company is not risky, first of all, they're going to fire your ass. Sorry.
Let it fly.
They don't care. You're just a name on a list. You got 50,000 employees, 100,000 employees, whatever the number is. There's nothing personal about it, right? They're just going to do what they're going to do. So there's no security in working for a large company, not more than a smaller company. I mean, so what do you want to do? You know, equity is the key to building wealth. Otherwise, you're just working for a paycheck. And that's great. You can pay your mortgage or your apartment or, you know, have a nice car, whatever. But, you know, can you really put your kids through college now at, pick a number? I don't know, 300 grand? And then everybody's got to go to graduate school, so another 100, you know, I mean, you know, it's an expensive undertaking, right, for us. So those are the lessons.
Those are great. Final question.
Sure.
We have to run, but so there's going to be people here who might come up to you today or might want to approach you or someone like you in the future. 1 minute answer to this question. Like, what is the best way to communicate to get you more interested, get you interested in their idea? Because I'm sure you're getting emails and LinkedIn messages all the time. Like, is it an introduction? Is it, what's the thing that sort of catches your attention?
Somebody who's really smart, who's has a phenomenal personality, who's a good storyteller, who has a project that has a big TAM, you know, on and on and on, right? So, but you know, look, there's only so much bandwidth that any individual has, so you know, I'm kind of full up. But on the other hand, you know, I'm always interested, and it's part of my problem is that, you know, I should have just, you know, retired and gone fishing or something, but I love the medical device business. I feel privileged to have been in it for over four decades. I'm in the mode where I do want to give back. I'm willing to talk and share my experience. So, you know, we're very privileged to be in the medical device business. It's a good thing. We are helping people in the end. It all comes down to the patient in the end. I didn't talk about platitudes today. Mm-hmm. Right? I talked about the hard stuff that people need to do. You know, it's fine. You know, if I work for one of the big strategics, I can get on stand and I can talk, you know, up on a stage and I can talk about how we do everything. It's about the patient and, you know, we're putting them first. And, you know, that's great. Yeah, because you got this huge business, right? And you can say those things. But when you're scrappy and you're trying to create something and do something, you need scrappers. You need gunslingers and scrappers and people that are willing to really put in the time and the effort and so on and so forth that don't have a magic business card. Mm-hmm. You know, what separates people, right? I work for one of those big players. I got a magic business card. People will give me the time of day. Show up with a card that for a company has nobody ever heard of. Okay, that's a difference, yeah. Right there. So those are the people I want to surround myself with. People who've showed up with a card and a company that nobody's ever heard of and made something happen.
Yep, sounds great. All right, Race, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was awesome. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Thanks again to our sponsor, Lydium Medical. Go to lydium.com for more information. LIGHTEUM.com. That's lydium.com. Thanks to Dr. Sarah Matt for joining us and for Ray Cohen for the help he gave at Device Talks West. Happy to share that conversation here. Thanks, of course, to all of you for being part of Device Talks in 2025. I hope you'll join us for the remainder of our podcast season and join us in 2026, not only on our podcast, but on our webinars and our in-person meetings. Device Talks Boston is happening May 27th and 28th. But before that, we'll be in Minnesota. Device Talks Minnesota is happening first on May 4th. All right, folks, that is a wrap. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast.